The Hotel Lux on Tverskaya Street in central Moscow was no ordinary hotel. In the 1920s and 30s, it served as a home to a diverse group of people, exiles or emigres from their home countries, with one important thing in common. They were all committed communists. The living quarters of the world revolution, so-called, played host to some of the most influential figures in the communist movement, including a young Ho Chi Minh and Tito. A new book explores the lives of some of the lesser-known figures who passed through its hallways, including one Irish resident who's never previously been written about in any detail. It's an international story about people united by the dream of communist global revolution. As we'll hear, it's also a love story which spans generations. The book is called Hotel Lux, An Intimate History of Communism's Forgotten Radicals. The author is my guest, Dr. Maurice Casey, historian at Queen's University Belfast, who joins me now in studio. Maurice, welcome to The History Show.
Thanks very much, Miles. It's great to be here.
Now, the book, it actually began life as your PhD thesis on Irish women and international communism when you learnt about a woman named May O'Callaghan from County Wexford. Now, until I read the book, I'd never heard, I'm sure like a lot of people, of May O'Callaghan from County Wexford. Who was she?
Yes, well, Miles, I got to month one of my PhD on Irish women and communism without having heard of her. Before this book, one of the only published references to May O'Callaghan referred to her as a mystery woman. My route into finding her was in an old out-of-print communist memoir from the 1930s, which was all written using pseudonyms. But in that book, the author, Joseph Freeman, referenced an Irish woman who was his boss in Moscow. So I used some other references to basically crack his pseudonym and figure out who this woman was. And that led me to a tranche of letters in the University of Oregon. And those letters were written by this woman, May O'Callaghan. They began in 1924 and ended in 1970. And those letters told this remarkable story of her long life. And they were written to a woman who she first met in the Hotel Lux. And so that was my starting point. And I set out to really uncover what led this Wexford woman, who was born in a middle-class Catholic family in the 1880s, who had a remarkable education at the University of Vienna, what led her to ultimately be in Moscow in the 1920s?
And she was a linguist, she was a suffragist, she was remarkable in many respects. Just give me a little bit of background before she arrives in Moscow in 1924, the year that Lenin died.
May O'Callaghan studied languages at the University of Vienna, and she was in Vienna at a very interesting period. And she was actually the English language tutor to Ludwig Boltzmann, a very prominent physicist. She was drawn to Vienna in part because an older sister had ended up there, had married an Austrian businessman. So already you have a sense that this family was quite unusual for Wexford of the time. Her Austrian brother-in-law sent her to America to promote his shipping business. But as she was on her way to America, she stopped off in London in 1914 and World War I broke out. She decided to remain in London, fatefully, and she answered an advert in a newspaper seeking a sub-editor for a new feminist journal called The Woman's Dreadnought. That newspaper was edited by Sylvia Pankhurst, today one of the best known of the suffragettes of the early 20th century. And May O'Callaghan becomes a close ally of Sylvia Pankhurst from 1914 up until around her departure for Moscow. And so this paper, The Woman's Dreadnought, has also a very important role in the history of the Irish Revolution. It's really one of the most sympathetic to Irish Republicans of all British papers, and certainly all British papers on the left. And in part, that's because it had Irish women like May O'Callaghan on its staff. But what's also really important for where May O'Callaghan ends up next and ending up in Moscow is where that paper is published, which is East London. East London, which from the 1880s onwards became a major reception point for Eastern European Jewish refugees fleeing Tsarist anti-Semitism in the Russian Empire, where they land and they end up alongside an earlier generation of Irish migrants who had left after and during the famine. And so this paper speaks to a peculiarly Irish, Jewish, Eastern European world where people have these kind of hyphenated identities, which May O'Callaghan will spend her whole life within, of Jewish worlds, of Irish worlds, and of revolutionary Eastern European worlds.
And what takes her to Moscow in 1924?
Well, in a way, she's pushed there by a sweep of history that begins with the 1917 revolution. After the October Revolution and the Bolshevik seizure of power, they set out to spread the revolution internationally. And the main Bolshevik vehicle for doing this is an organization called the Communist International, or the Comintern. When the Comintern gets going, it's one of these early 20th century experiments in international organizations like the League of Nations and so on. And it requires a specific kind of staff member, multilingual, able to use a typewriter, secretarially trained, basically a job description for someone like Mayo Callan, who had spent the war years working as a sub-editor for the Woman's Dreadnought in a multilingual world, who knew French and German from her time in Vienna and learned Russian in the world of East London amongst Eastern European immigrants. So suddenly this revolution, which brings to power a movement that sees its own route to victory through a wider European revolution in Germany, in France and elsewhere, suddenly that revolution is looking for employees, and Mayo Callahan is in search of an adventure, and she's in search of a form of employment that will also allow her to pursue her own political convictions, which are revolutionary.
And Mayo Callahan finds the Hotel Lux. So how did the Hotel Lux become home to so many radicals, including, you know, as I said in my introduction, a couple of really, really famous ones from all over the world?
So the hotel itself began life as a boutique hotel set up by a wealthy banking family. After the revolution, as the Bolsheviks begin to seize these large structures, be it palaces, former mansions, hotels, they seize them with the intent of, for a number of reasons, to house their new commissariats, their ministries, to function as meeting places for congresses, to become sites of their own social experiments around housing peasant communities and so on. But there's also the need that they have for accommodation for their international guests. And the early Soviet Union, it really becomes a reception point for people who are fleeing charges of sedition, fleeing, taking part in insurrectionary acts, and are leaving for Moscow in search of a revolutionary home. And so the Lux becomes, almost through a series of both being designated as a dormitory, but also just this mass wave of migration from Western Europe, this wave of radical migration, it becomes this home because it was central. It was near to the Comintern's headquarters, which was about a 30-minute walk away. It was close to the Kremlin, which is the center of power. And it simply had the facilities that the Bolsheviks required. Now, it wasn't luxury. It was always kind of in a state of disrepair. The food was pretty horrible in the canteen, and it would be some years before people got their own communal kitchens. It had a non-functioning elevator, and it only really got worse over the decades. But at least for that generation that were there in the 1920s, it became such a part of their own biographies because it was such a unique space where you could go down to the canteen, and even though the food was underwhelming, you were sitting there with your spoon and your borscht and looking around you. You were seeing people who were the leading revolutionary
figures. You could have that with Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah, you could. You could have literally have a a pretty bland biscuit with Ho Chi Minh, yeah.
Now, she was there from 1924 to 1928. That sounds like a pretty long stay, wasn't it? Or was that the norm?
It was an exceptionally long stay. It was exceptionally long for a number of reasons, one of which is a kind of a practical reason, which is that she was very skilled at what she did. She was able to move pretty much seamlessly through Russian, English, French and German, which, again, were some of the most important languages for the Comintern. She also had a very wide social network, and her room in the Hotel Lux, room number 5, becomes something of a literary salon where Western intellectuals had meetings with Soviet academics and Soviet writers and poets. So there's that social aspect that keeps her tied to Moscow. She also was, and this may be somewhat confusing, but she was actually never an official member of a communist party. She was never a card-carrying communist. A lot of the communist activists who ended up in Moscow were party members, and so their home parties would recall them after a year or so, once they'd undergone their training within the revolutionary headquarters. Mayo Callahan was never recalled, because although she was revolutionary and on the left in her sympathies, she never made the step of joining up to the party.
So there was no one to recall her.
There was no one to recall her, exactly.
But, I mean, one of the things she does, for example, I find this absolutely extraordinary, is that she is the lead translator in debates, these hectic debates, ferocious debates between Stalin and Trotsky in the aftermath of the death of Lenin.
Yes, so you have to imagine this is, of course, a period before we have Google Translate. And it's even a period before we have the kind of headset translation of simultaneous translation, which actually comes into the Comintern in 1928. So she just misses that convenience. But this was a very elaborate process where you would have someone like Trotsky give a speech and people would kind of groan when he would get to the podium because he would legendarily give the speeches in all the languages he spoke again and again. So he could rattle on for hours. So he would be at the podium, and beneath the podium would be a table of mainly women, people who were practiced in stenography, so shorthand, and they would take notes on the speeches in Russian or in their own languages. Then they would be passed through these notes to another room where Mae O'Callaghan was managing the English language translation team. And her team would then read through the stenography reports in the original Russian. All the English delegates would gather around her, and her team would then read it back the speech to them in English. So it was this process of consecutive translation, which was quite convoluted, but was as efficient a solution as they could have with the technology of the time to this issue, which was that this was an organization whose ambitions were global in intent, and therefore it needed to mobilize as many language professionals as it could. And that really, for me, was just one of these really remarkable moments to think that in these, not only these showdowns between Trotsky and Stalin, but in the debates that decide the future of the Chinese Communist Party, in that room when those debates were taking place was a woman raised in a coastal village in Wexford. It's kind of extraordinary to think.
And she never renounced her Irishness. She had her own cultural life, didn't she? Was somebody who was very interested in James Joyce.
Yes, so she...
And this is the early 20s. This is not James Joyce in the, you know, in the 1940s or 1950s.
No, exactly. She, when I began looking into Mae O'Callaghan first, I was looking for different worlds where I may have found her. And I came across a study of Joyce and Russia by a scholar named Neil Cornwell. And he noted that the first ever Russian language serious essay about Joyce was written by a mystery person by the name of Eugene Fogarty. Now, as I researched, I realized that this was actually Mae O'Callaghan's pseudonym. So Mae O'Callaghan was the first person to write seriously about James Joyce in a Russian language essay. She corresponded with Joyce, but really, as is one of the kind of key strands of the book, the most dramatic relationship for her is her relationship between the relationship between Mae and the Irish writer Liam O'Flaherty.
Okay, now the O'Flahertys, Liam and his older brother Tom O'Flaherty, come into this story. How do they fit in?
They are certainly, Liam blunders into the story at several points and causes a bit of a ruckus. But Liam and Tom, I often say that no cottage on the Atlantic seaboard contributed more to the world revolution than the O'Flaherty homestead on Inishmore, because you've Liam, who becomes a founding member of the Irish Communist Party, and you've got Tom, his older brother, who becomes a founding member of the US Communist Party. So Tom is actually the first of the O'Flaherty brothers to make it to Moscow, and he spent some time in the Hotel Lux in 1926. He was there debating different positions on the coming American Revolution with the Comintern. May knew Tom when he was in the hotel, and it's possibly through Tom that she's first introduced to the writings of Liam O'Flaherty. Liam O'Flaherty had started publishing in the early 1920s, and he was getting a lot of recognition at this point, and Mae O'Callaghan begins writing to him from Moscow, and she begins trying to arrange for the publication of his works in the Russian language through her very elite Soviet cultural friends. And so it begins this bond between Mae and Liam that has a very unusual consequence. And this is something that I discovered right back when I first discovered that tranche of letters that Mae O'Callaghan wrote to her friend that ended up in the University of Oregon. I found a very dramatic letter from 1928 where Mae reveals that a close friend of hers, actually a woman that she knew from her East London days, who also entered into the world of communism alongside Mae, a woman called Nellie Cohen, Mae had introduced her new friend Liam O'Flaherty to Nellie Cohen, and Liam O'Flaherty had brought Nelly to a London hotel room. They drank a lot of whiskey, sung some Irish songs. They slept together. And the result was that Nelly had become pregnant in 1928 with Liam O'Flaherty's second daughter, Joyce.
But Liam was not aware of this ever.
Liam would learn of Joyce's existence when she was around 30. She began writing letters to him. And he initially ignored the letters, but they did make a connection when this daughter was in her 30s, Joyce. But for May, when this news breaks, in 1928, she becomes very determined to help Nelly through this, seeing herself partly responsible for the entire affair. So she leaves Moscow behind. She travels to London, where Nelly is in the early stages of the pregnancy. And then they travel on to New York, which is where Nelly eventually gives birth to Joyce in February of 1929. And so that is the end of May's Moscow career in many ways, but it has some extraordinary legacies. And she goes on to, for many years, raise this child, Joyce, in collaboration with Nelly.
And then there's a follow-on, is there not, into the next generation?
Well, yes. So I actually begin the book with a scene from May's life in the Hotel Lux, a very important scene with extraordinary reverberations. In May 1925, May O'Callaghan's close friend in the hotel, a woman named Emmy Leonhard, who was the partner of a man named Ed O'Fimmon, very prominent Dutch trade unionist who was a leading organiser in anti-Nazi resistance networks later on. Emmy Leonhard went into labour in the Hotel Lux, and May O'Callaghan called a taxi, paid for the taxi fare to bring Emmy to the Kremlin Hospital, where Emmy gave birth to her first daughter, Elisa. So that's towards the beginning of May's time in the hotel. And so May's time in the hotel becomes bookended by the birth of these two daughters, Elisa, born in 1925, and Joyce, born in 1929 in New York. When I set out to trace May O'Callaghan, I first called up her last will and testament from the registry office. And I saw that she had passed all of her materials to Nellie Cohen, her good friend and Joyce's mother. Through Nellie's will, I saw that she had passed her materials to her daughter, Joyce. And then I saw in Joyce's will that she had passed it to her goddaughter. And I found this goddaughter, Pippa, who actually, it turned out, was living just a short bus ride away from me from where I was doing my PhD in Oxford. I met Pippa, and I told her that I was interested in this Irish woman, May O'Callaghan, and she said that she had not heard of May O'Callaghan, but she let me look through some materials that she had belonging to Joyce. And towards the end of my first trip to meet Pippa, she told me as well that there's a box of love letters that belong to Joyce, and they're in the attic, and that I could take a look at them. She said they were written by someone called Elsa, and that immediately just set off fireworks in my mind. And I was like, do you mean Elisa? And she thought, yes, you know, you could be right. And so I went up to the attic with the torch on my phone and I propped open the plastic box, and it's full of decades of love letters.
This is why historians have fun with archives, folks.
And these letters were written by Elisa. They were written by the girl who was born in the Kremlin Hospital in 1925 to Joyce. And suddenly I had this, you know, this mental montage of the 20th century playing out in my head. And I, as I researched more, I discovered that it was May O'Callaghan who had introduced these two women to each other on the other side of the Second World War when they were adults, and they fell in love. And so this one relationship, you can understand it against this whole sweep of history. These two women would not have met were it not for the Irish Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and the Hotel Lux. It's what brought that love story together. And then I was fortunate once more, using that box of love letters, I was able to trace Elisa's living nephew, because she wrote in a 1970 letter that she had a new nephew and his name was Pierre. It took me some years to trace him, in part because he is now known as Pedro, but I eventually traced him to northern Spain, and he invited me over to his home in 2021. And what I was really, the kind of full stop I really wanted to put on this story was whether the other side of the love letters had survived. I had Elisa's letters to Joyce, but what had become of Joyce's letters to Elisa? I told Pedro that that was really one of the key things I wanted to discover. If I discovered that they had been destroyed, they no longer existed, fine, that would be a full stop. We spent about 3 days Pedro had kept so much of material writing to his grandparents, and it was chaotically organized. I mean, I'd open up a box and it would have things like manuals for Star Wars toys belonging to his kids and handwritten letters by the French philosopher Simone Weil. These would be in the same box together. So it was 3 days before Pedro came into his kitchen with a black bin bag and he said to me, "Morris, I found the letters." And that was just the most extraordinary moment for me in my research career. We open up the bin bag and there I see the sign off, "Love, Joyce." And so both sides of this correspondence had survived. And so that's really what the book builds towards. It tells many different threads, many different stories, but it's in many ways, it's about providing a deep contextualization into this one romance. And I was also really delighted as well to find this photograph that Pedro had kept, which shows Joyce and Elisa on O'Connell Bridge in Dublin. So this is just a year or two after Joyce connected with her father, Liam O'Flaherty, and she discovers this Irish identity. And so she brings the love of her life to Dublin and they're photographed on O'Connell Bridge. And it's that location that many people will be familiar with. I believe that the photo was taken by the man on the bridge.
Yeah. Professional photograph.
Yes, yeah. I imagine it was. 90% sure.
Every family in Ireland has got at least one photograph in their of that nature in their collection.
Yeah, but for me, that photograph was just such an incredible moment because here was I, an Irish person who's walked across that spot I don't know how many times, and I'm looking at this photograph and I know exactly the story that's being shown here. These are two women in love. The other Dubliners pass them by in the street, might just see two friends arm in arm, but they're two women in love brought together by an extraordinary sweep of history. And for that story to survive, for the elements for us to put those pieces of the jigsaw together, that for me was what really convinced me that I needed to write this book.
It's an incredibly complex and an incredibly engaging story. But we started with May. Let's finish with May. What happens to her after the hotel looks years? Because I must admit, reading the book, I had a notion in my head, okay, 1924, 1928, does she fall foul of Stalin?
May O'Callaghan, in a way, she does get pushed out of the Comintern, although she leaves by her own choice because she wants to help Nelly. She did want to return. However, she couldn't return, and she later learned that's because there were rumours swirling around that she was a Trotskyist. Right at the time when these kind of rumours could lose you a job, but not necessarily yet lose you your life. So May O'Callaghan was fortunate in a sense that she leaves and she doesn't return at that time. Now, many of her friends, many of those she left behind, were not so fortunate. Rose Cohen, who was a British communist and the sister of her close friend Nellie, Joyce's mother, Rose Cohen married a Ukrainian revolutionary, David Petrovsky, and both Rose and David Petrovsky were executed in 1937. Another of May's very close friends, Sergei Dynamov, a Soviet literary scholar who helped her and Liam O'Flaherty get his novels to Soviet audiences, he also is executed. He's executed in 1939. And there's a letter that I discovered when I went to Moscow in 2018. I went to the archives, the state literature archives in a suburb of Moscow, and I discovered a letter that May O'Callaghan had written to her friend Sergei. And she had written this in 1936 when things were ramping up and life was becoming scarier for many of the people she had left behind. But it's clear from her tone that she doesn't understand what's going on and she doesn't understand the danger that's being faced by those she's left behind there. And that letter doesn't make it to Sergei because he had already been fired from the editorial board to which she was writing because he was seen to have had connections to another literary figure who was falling afoul of Stalinist orthodoxies. So May O'Callaghan survives this period by chance, but also basically by being the beneficiary of malevolent gossip at the right time. Many of her friends do not survive it. She spends the 1930s working in a left-wing bookstore. The 1940s, she lives outside of London with Nellie, with Joyce, and with Nellie's husband, Hugo, who she marries later in the 1930s, and who actually lived in the Hotel Lux as well in the 20s. He lived in room 349. I've learned all these numbers off. And then she settles into a cozy retirement into the 50s and the 60s. But she has this living connection to her life in Moscow through the love between these two women, Joyce and Elisa. She always remained very close to Emmy, Elisa's mother, who she brought to the Kremlin Hospital in 25. And I opened the book with Emmy's letter to Nelly after May's death in 1973. She, I guess you could say, maybe became more moderate in her opinions. She was a huge fan of JFK. She also wrote approvingly of Conor Cruise O'Brien during the first phase of Conor Cruise O'Brien. And she dies in 1973 in a North London nursing home. And there's only two people at her funeral, and that's Nelly and Joyce. And so it's this extraordinary life that ends in obscurity. I don't think that Mayo Callahan would have imagined that it would have ended any other way. I don't think that she felt that she had played a prominent role in history because she wasn't the leading revolutionary. She was the typesetter. She was the translator. She was the editor.
She was the observer.
She was the observer. But through her eyes, we encounter this history through the perspective of someone who's much closer to us in temperament, in vulnerabilities, in contradictions. She was not someone like Lenin, who was an obsessive ideological thinker. She was not someone like Sylvia Pankhurst, who used to only sleep 5 days out of every seven because she had so much work to do. She was an ordinary person with these ordinary fallibilities, these ordinary moral compromises that come with living a life of commitment. And that, to me, is what made her so fascinating.
Well, she may have been an ordinary person, but it's an extraordinary story, an amazing feat of research on your part to tie all these strands of the narrative together between bin bags and attic searches. And this evening we've touched on just some of the characters and the relationships revealed in the book. The book is called Hotel Lux, An Intimate History of Communism's Forgotten Radicals, published by Footnote Press. The author is my guest, Dr. Maurice Casey. Maurice, many thanks for joining us and telling us the story of Mayo Callahan.
Thanks so much, Miles.